Welcome back to the Millennial Dentist Podcast, a podcast all about working smarter, not harder, pushing dentists to go beyond dental school dentistry and build the practice of your dreams. Here is your host, the Millennial Dentist himself, Dr. Sully Sullivan.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast, new and improved, back in action. I'm excited. This is actually probably one of my first interviews since I started re-recording again. Yeah, and I'm excited. Today, we're going to talk about some really what they are as KPIs for your practice, things that we should be tracking, looking at. And then specifically with that, I brought on a guest who I'll introduce here shortly. I'll bring on Mike here. Mike Abernathy, everybody. Mike, say hey.
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm awake.
So Mike's been in the industry. How long have you been doing this? How long have you been kind of working with
this? I started when I was in high school as a lab technician. And by the time I was in college, I was a master ceramist and paid my way through dental school doing lab work for all the professors that did really crappy work in dental school. So I guess 50-something years.
57 years. So I'd say you got some wisdom to pass along. So now these days you're not doing dentistry as much, but you're helping kind of coach to consult with dentists. And honestly, it's kind of fun. One of the things that I know you is one of the other things that you do is practice transitions. And so Mike was integral in kind of our transition about 5 years ago when I bought half of my dad's practice. And so anywho, that's kind of how I know him. But yeah, but what we're going to get into, like I said, I mentioned earlier, is these KPIs. And obviously, when you've done it as long as Mike is, you kind of have a good idea of what you want to look for in practices. So I get this blog post the other day, and my initial reaction was, this is all wrong. I was like, I can't disagree more with half of this stuff. So that's kind of the teaser, so to speak. But ultimately, what I'm seeing is, and Mike, what I want to do is I want to jump into these and start to kind of go through your blog post. And for those of you that would like to read it, I'm sure, Mike, are your blog posts on your website?
I mean, it's not my website. I mean, I don't own Summit, but on summitpracticesolutions.com, it's plural, there is a quick link to articles I've written. So there's probably 600 or 700 articles, and the last few have been about transitions of either looking for a job or hiring someone, you know, either for partnership or as an employee. So
yeah. So if you go to Summit Practice Solutions, just Google that. I'm sure you'll find it. And then under there, there's going to be a blog post called Associateships, Partnerships by the Numbers Part 2. And so I get these. I've been subscribed because I like to hear what he has to say. And every now and then I'll read some of these. And this one jumped out at me just because I like tracking numbers. And the larger our practice gets, the more I like to kind of look into the numbers and start to truly run my business like a business, which is kind of funny because most dentists, you know, I think are not great at running their businesses like the business. They run it like a dentist, which isn't always as ideal. So let's just jump into these because, you know, what I'm seeing, Mike, in our industry is getting more and more pressure from corporate dentistry, from lack of reimbursements, from inflation now this year, to that a lot of what I would argue that a lot of the old metrics that we went by can be misleading or should be, we should start looking at them in a different lens. And I think what will happen is my assumption is we're going to go through these. And when you give your point, I'll be like, that's valid. And then when I give my point, my assumption is we'll probably be like, yes, that's valid. Like we'll agree on some of this stuff. But I'm interested to see kind of your thoughts on a couple of these where I'm like, I try to get the opposite of that metric on some level. So without further ado, let's jump on into this.
Now keep in mind that I'm still in dentistry. I just don't practice every day, but still got practices. And I try to start or buy about 5 or 6 a year. So again,
you're doing something right.
These metrics are not old metrics. These are metrics.
I know they're not old metrics, but maybe we'll get into this in the nitty gritty of this, Mike, is that perhaps the way you run a practice should contribute to what metrics you focus on. Meaning that like the style of in which you want to practice dictates the metrics that you look for. And maybe that's something that gets overlooked a lot is, and we'll kind of, let's get into this because we can discuss this as it goes. So the first metric is $25,000 to $30,000 of production per operatory per month. And so when you look at a 5-op practice, you would like to see that production between $125,000 and $150,000. So talk to the listeners a little bit about kind of what you're looking at. And that's a top line number.
Yeah, I mean that might be a goal. The average in the United States is $14,000 or less per op. And so, again, I mean, I think, you know, and you could, I know we're going to talk about employees too, but there are metrics that, while it's not a standalone metric, it's a metric that allows you, because when I'm looking at practices, I'm looking at purchasing them. I'm looking at the value added side of it and a goal that I know I can easily reach if it's run correctly. Now, I see fee-for-service practices. I see insurance-dependent practices. I see Medicaid practices. I don't buy Medicaid practices, but we have started Medicaid practices for people, and they're operated totally different too. But most of the practices that I've owned have all been general practices, maybe 75% insurance. I mean, it may be a little less than that in some, but some are a little bit higher depending on what part of the country they're in. They're not in Texas. None of them are in Texas right now. So, yeah, I mean, that number, $25,000 to $30,000 per op, is a doable amount, but I see an average practice doing 14 or less. So what's your question, or what would you like to counter with there?
So the question is this $25,000 to $30,000 per operatory, and then kind of give me your response. Why you see that metric, or what why is that the target for your metric?
I don't know if I can give you the why. I think it's a, if I look at
relative to the average is what you're saying.
I'm sorry?
It's relative to the average.
Yes and no. I mean, I think, okay, originally I looked at it from the perspective of profitability. You read the book Profit First or something like that. I looked at it from profitability, and I found that practices I looked at that had less than maybe 20,000 or so per employee and 25,000 per op per month, their P&Ls were skewed to be average or worse.
Yeah,
absolutely. We know it's like 650 to 750 a year. That's about 55 to 62 or 63 a month with 4 to 5 employees. The numbers didn't work well, right? But if you take it and we're in reverse engineering, and you go, if I'm producing, you know, 25 to 30,000, and I'm not suggesting that should be your goal. What I'm suggesting is if you fail to meet that goal, the ripple effect of that is we go back and look at other metrics in your practice. They're going to be less than ideal. Now, that may be by choice that you do that. It may be by demographic that you do that, or by the fact that you don't do certain procedures that yield a higher profit.
Okay, so here's kind of my rebuttal to that. Why I don't, I think that the metric in that regard doesn't provide enough value or incentive, or isn't broken down in detailed enough. So what I like to look, so I kind of came to this resolution when we were in 8 operatories trying to run 3 dentists, we really started to appreciate the value of what an operatory looks like. And on some level, that's what you're what we're referencing is okay. Is if instead of looking at your top line number, let's break this all the way down to operatory and say that okay, well, if I'm doing, $1 million and I have 5 operatories and I'm doing $200,000 out of each operatory, how can I up that number and below that number? So then you start to look at the data and say, okay, well, within my practice, what's a hygiene operatory worth? And in a PPO environment, like a hygiene operatory in reality is somewhere between like a 15 to 18 grand. That's kind of like your the peak that you could get from hygiene, right? Like give or take a couple grand.
if that's what you get, that's not what we get.
Well, so that, and that's going to get into other metrics, but I would say yes, in a PPO environment, like let's say what's best practice, Mike, out of a hygiene chair in a PPO environment?
35.
Okay. Now,
yeah, I mean, but that's unusual. And again, the point of looking at this is,
and I'm going to hold that number because I want to go to that one. We may go to that one next.
Okay. That's fine.
But let's say, so 35 is high. And then let's call it 20 is average. From what
I think that's probably high for average.
Okay, you think it's high. Okay, so perfect. Let's use
12 to 14 is probably.
Well, I can't do that math, so let's do 15. Okay. You gotta give me even
numbers. Okay, yeah, so keep it in whole numbers here.
Yeah, exactly. So 15K is the value of our hygiene op.
Yep.
Now what's the value of a doctor op?
Okay. And on the doctor, but
and then it depends on the doctor. And so what's average GP going to be? Is 50K okay?
How much?
50K?
Per month. Okay. It's below that. I mean, their total collections in an average practice a month is 55 to 62,000. Hygiene is going to do, let's say, about 25 to a third of that. So it would be, if we took a third, let's say if it was 60, we took a third of that, the doctor would be just doing around 40. So
those doctors need to get better, but that's aside. So let's use 40. So now all of a sudden, if I ask you, Mike, as a business owner, you can, and then the challenge I have is that, and we'll get into this, the weeds here, but is if I could have an operatory that can put a $40,000 producer in it versus a $15,000 producer in it, which would you rather have?
The one that produces more.
The one that produces more. That seems very obvious. And so the challenge we get, and then the next part about that is though, is for most dentists, is $40,000 an operatory a fair number when they're running multiple operatories?
Yes.
I would say no. So to me, if you're doing $40,000 and you're taking up two operatories, your net per operatory is really 20 grand.
Well, not if, okay. Okay. You're talking about production per op. Okay.
Yes.
I think it's very possible for a doctor that has two ops to do $80,000 a month in production.
Absolutely. So then, okay. but their net value per op is 40 grand.
Right.
So part of it is when you start to look like, when I start to think of, so part of this is because my philosophy is one doctor, one chair, meaning I want to maximize my production out of one chair, because in my mind, because every time I take that doctor's production and they run multiple chairs, I'm really, it's diluting their production per operatory.
Okay.
And so what I want to do is I want to try to find a way to maximize my operatory. And then as a business owner, I would rather bring in another doctor to then run the second operatory versus giving them each an individual one.
Yeah, and I totally disagree with that.
So tell me why you disagree with that. Because I'm
well, I mean, I don't think that 99% of the doctors that are looking for a job right now could produce at the level I produce at. And I don't hop from chair to chair. But when I do a, like, I can do a root canal, ground prep, build up, temporary, and do that in about an hour. And someone's already set somebody in the other room. Okay, so we're moving away from production per op to production for the office. That having that second,
I don't like production per office. Production per your chairs, per your op.
Okay. Yeah, but you have a reality rhetoric gap here, in that you're suggesting that if I had a second op and I was working out of both, and that I couldn't maximize one op. Right?
I guess what I'm would be arguing in that case would be that it's impossible for one doctor to produce the same. If I could double you and put you each in an operatory, one of you can't do it because you can't be in two places at once.
Yes and no. When you double your doctors, you double your cost of doing the procedure.
No, you don't. That's not true.
You're saying that if I had a doctor, let's say an owner, mm-hmm. working out of one op,
mm-hmm.
put in an employee in the other op.
Right.
And I'm paying him, let's say, 30%.
Correct.
The net, again, net, we have overhead for the office, which affects both ops.
Correct.
Plus, in one op, the overhead of the doctor.
There's only one. There's one. Only one increase in overhead there from a business owner. So let's back up once, because one of the problems we're going to have, Mike, is that we have to define that where you're going is that you're not counting the owner doctor in the overhead. And I would disagree with that. I do,
but I don't care. I don't do it up front. I mean, there's no E in EBITDA for probably most of the average practices out there, right? There's no real earnings. I mean, they take home 20 to 30%. And that's just what was, it was the net for the practice. It wasn't really their earnings.
Yeah, but to me, at the sum of this entire conversation, if you're going to go through all the headache, all the risk, all right. the drama of owning a business,
right.
should be people, the doctors should understand that, like, you should be trying to make some sort of value of owning that. Otherwise, just go be an employee.
Right. No, I agree. No, completely. But again, in the scheme of owning a practice, I have if we're going to factor it that way, then I have a certain cost for me being there. Let's say.
Yes, exactly.
30%.
Bingo. And, the cost to replace yourself if you're a hands-off owner.
Right. And the net is mine too. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So in a dental practice.
Let me pause you for 2 seconds just to clarify to the listener what we're talking about. Basically what we're saying is that in a one doc practice, Sully Dentist LLC and Sully Owner LLC gets kind of watered down together because I take it all in a situation where I'm a one
doc. Right.
It passes through all to me. What I'm an advocate for is that I, even if it's on paper, start to allocate that Sully the dentist costs 30%, 32%, whatever your number is to replace you as an associate, that's what your cost is. So if you truly want to see, is my business successful, then Sully the business owner should make some percentage after me as the associate's paid. So that's kind of where what Mike and I are processing quickly.
But if you look at it from a purely legal IRS type standpoint, none of us own our practices. We are shareholders in a corporation. We're 100% shareholders if we've got a solo practice. And we're paid as an employee. And oftentimes, we own the building. We're the landlord, too.
Okay? Right.
So we wear many hats.
Correct.
And the only thing that matters is the net at the end of the day for a business. And so we can dig down and put them in stacks, but.
Well, and I don't want to get into the weeds in that because what you're alluding to is that there's, we're going to shift those numbers on paper to minimize tax burden when you own everything and you kind of get to move the money under the cups where it makes the most tax standpoint.
Well, not necessarily, because when you value a practice, we normalize the profit and loss statement to minimize.
Correct. Take all that out.
I mean, purely from a scientific, we're just really trying to dig down and look at real profitability. We normalize that and realize that, yeah, you've got a storage building for records that just happens to have a bass boat in it. And you write it. No, I mean.
So I get you're going to take that stuff back out.
Pure overhead. Right. Okay.
So let's go back to our conversation. So then where we stopped to kind of pivot it a little there was that to add another doctor, we have a little bit of a disagreement on how much more that costs the practice.
Sure.
Because in my mind, all that costs the practice is an extra assistant.
Okay.
And so to me, I'd rather have two doctors producing 80 grand than having Super Mike producing 130 grand.
Okay.
And the logic behind
if
that.
If I'm paid on a percentage.
Yes.
That would be true. Now, for me, there's another level of the understanding. I would rather have this than that. I mean, what we're not talking about too is the added leadership responsibility.
Absolutely.
Okay. That it's more difficult to do this and find the right doctor for multiple.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's got to be factored in there somewhere.
So. Absolutely. It's 100. Yeah. And so I guess I'm looking at it from just a purely math standpoint, because you're correct. I mean, when you go into how I have to lead a doctor and then like I did a whole episode a while ago where it was called Feed Your Associate First. And that's that me as an owner, like my goal is to make sure their schedule is filled first, which is so counterintuitive to the reason a lot of doctors hire an associate is not, they don't look at it from a growing a business standpoint. They look at it to get rid of stuff they don't want to do or whatnot.
Well, one of those articles predating this was that very point that, again, there's a point at which you're not ready for another doctor. If you can't feed them, the patients and the training and the staff, and you have that system of capacity with staffing and facility for them to be successful.
So part of the reason I get into this is because what I see too is that you've got most solo docs, you know, run a typical 4 to 5 op practice. And so at some point they start to run into a ceiling based off their capacity, what they think they can do. And so your value for operatory really becomes important, because then either I got to upfront and move, which now has added costs, added pressure, all these things, or I try to change the way that I think a little bit. And so if I'm I believe that you can easily have two doctors running out of 4 ops. You have two hygienists, and then you have one doctor in each operatory, and that can easily go up, because instead of and again to that kind of operatory mindset, well, my two operatories with hygiene are limited to 20 grand, 15 grand, 30 grand in your case, you know, a high number. And then the second part of that is then now I'm, instead of diluting my production across two operatories, then I go to one operatory and I may drop my production down, but my top line production grows in that regard. And so that's kind of the way
that would necessarily, that doesn't make logical sense, but okay.
If yours drop,
okay, you're saying you got a second doctor working the other one.
Yes.
Okay. He may or may not produce at the level. So there may be even a more of a shortfall. I'm troubled with the idea that, I mean, certainly, you know, you use Comfort Dental. Okay. They'll have 3 docs, no hygienists, 6 ops, each doing over $1 million a piece, you know. Yes. A very profitable model, and Rick owns the buildings. Okay. But if we had an ideal practice and we were really inspiring our patients, I mean, however a patient might define that, you're remarkable and people want to come.
They want to spend money with you. Yeah.
Yeah. They want to buy your products and buy your services. The 4 op, I mean, you've always got a ceiling, because you mentioned that as a word, capacity in the facility, by supply and demand. And if an average practice, and I don't think anybody walked across the stage going, can't wait to be average, you know, averaged about 20 to 30 new patients. Okay. I mean, you know, and that would be whatever, 360 a year if it was 30. Hygienists can only see about, I don't know, 600 or so patients a year. If they see them twice and still see some new patients, do some scaling group planning, that there can be an artificial break on your growth if people want to come in and they can't get in because of the facility capacity problem.
Absolutely.
Okay. So again, I mean, scaling is one of those things that we're going to have to include in this formula.
Well, so here's the quick steps that I would do to knock that down really fast. So like, for me, the first thing that I look at is, okay, are you blocking new patients? You know, like, are we eliminating what you just said? Like, to me, there's no reason that. It's amazing how many patients don't block new patients. I mean, I practices don't block new patients. So they get the amount of new patients that their availability limits them to.
Yeah, and no, it's stupid. I agree.
Me, like what I would say is I would tell my team, like as soon as you can't get in within 2 weeks, we need to replace blocks. And so and add more new patient blocks so that I'm constantly growing into the availability that the demand will give me.
But you still have the capacity of the rooms.
But let's, if we extreme this out, I would say that I'll get rid of ReCare patients. Like at some point, if my volume of new patients exceeds, if it was a constant steady, I would just say, we no longer do ReCare here. We're one and done. Okay. Like at an extreme point, right? And you find that happy, but you're going to, at some point, you may find a capacity standpoint, but most offices, they try to jump to this new building, more stuff. And so when you do that, all you're doing is now multiplying your low cost per operatory across more operatories. You're growing at $20,000 an operate, which means to get really big, you got to just keep growing and adding more. And so to me, trying to get incremental growth is to go, where, how can I get my operatory from $20,000 to $40,000? And you're alluding to this. This is where we're not going to disagree on. You can't do $100,000 out of one operatory unless you start to change the way that you diagnose, the skill set that you have, allowing more patients to do more in fewer visits through stuff like sedation. Because I would argue that like an oral surgeon could do $500,000 out of one operatory. I mean, if you're doing dual arch hybrids a day, that's $40,000 a day. It's just how many days do they want to work?
Right. But you know, I think you do a disservice. I mean, anybody that writes or speaks in public does a disservice to some of the audience if you don't speak to the average doctor. I mean, that's, you know,
that's a great point and interesting. Keep going.
I mean, because you know, if you've done this as long as I've done it and had owned as many practices as I've owned in so many states, I feel like the legacy I want to leave is advice that dumbs down the variables and allows them to grow to the point of understanding that next level. And you're at that next level.
Dentists and build them to be mediocrity dentists.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just going.
That's a great point.
So again, when I speak or I write something down, I try to, you know, obviously I look at certain numbers and certainly each one of those numbers, if they weren't in not necessarily ideal, but in a really good number, or they, you know, they weren't good, I could look at them and underneath them would be all these other little things that we could do. The one thing you didn't mention in that growth was the type of patients that you would attract, that you have to attract to make that one op do that. And that is a whole different
discussion. So let me scale this back. Because what you're saying is that, well, yes, when you talk about high-end cosmetics, implant dentistry, now we're getting into marketing, you know, a whole other animal. I agree.
Right.
I would argue, though, that you will grow in your practice if instead of doing one crown on eight patients a day, start doing two crowns and two fillings on five patients a day.
If the patients needed two crowns or five crowns, I agree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm never insinuating that, but I would say most doctors, they treatment plan based off, most dentists don't give patients the opportunity to say yes to stuff.
I agree. But aren't you in Brentwood?
I am.
I mean, you look at your demographic.
But that's not fair, because let me tell you, because yes, Brentwood's the wealthiest county in Tennessee.
But my demographic is exactly that.
No, but what I'm saying though is if you look at where our production comes from for zip code, the 50% of our production comes from an hour and a half away.
Right.
Because it's all dentistry that's being driven in towards marketing, but it's low income people. We don't make a lot of money because of where we live.
You do make a lot of money. Your dad was doing close to $2 million before you bought in.
He was doing 1.4, 1.5 out of five ops.
Okay, I think it's 1.8. But anyway, I mean, I do have the numbers. Okay, when that happened. Okay, so that's unfair. You know, but he built a reputation, a validity. You communicate really well and you have great people skills, but a lot of us don't have that. But Brent would be the last place I'd ever open a practice. You didn't let me finish. I was, you know, as if that was going to be a good place. I mean, but it's exactly like McKinney was. And my practice was a lot like yours is in that I attracted people maybe an hour from the side. McKinney was 30 miles north of Dallas. So on the side away from Dallas, I attracted 30 or 40 miles away. On the sides, 25 or 30, but only about 4 miles on the side close to Dallas. And so it's shaped like an A. But the demographics in the places where we, because we're starting out, we're listening, an audience is listening to you that is starting out at capacity. Every person that's listening to you, whatever their results now, is their capacity. I mean, if they have 15 new patients a month, they're not a 20 new patient a month. And so I think it's important to help them, I don't know what the right word is, but to bracket this in the fact that, you know, you have incredible people skills. I'm assuming you're a very confident clinician.
You're not wrong in that.
You're not wrong.
No, but what it comes down to is it fair to inspire someone to believe a dream they can't do because they can't be me?
Yes, because I think in setting a goal, the purpose
the goal
of,
should be realistic. I agree with you.
Is it to actually obtain the goal? I mean, you want to do that, but even if you fell short, it's becoming the person that would set the goal in the first place to strive to do better. And so we're going to have certain things that we can't overcome, but we're certainly better off chasing some of the things you talk about, chasing it. Even if we fall short, we're winning. We only lose, we don't get back up. So I think it's great to do that, but I think if we create a goal that is so lofty, or there's so many steps to get there, or it's such a big goal that we can't get it down to a point if they can understand it. There's too many numbers to, like, for example,
I don't agree with you there, but okay. What I do disagree with is that I don't think setting the goal as mediocrity or that's the standard to success is going to limit people and what they can
do. When did I ever set a goal that was for average, for mediocrity?
Well, I mean, I think that's a low goal. I think 25
for what?
Low.
What?
Per operatory.
Okay, great. But you're going to find 90% of the people out there couldn't even get that.
I don't disagree with you on that.
That's not a mediocre goal, though, right?
I want to speak to the people that are above average.
Right. That's what I did. Okay. But again, your audience, that would be knowing what the average practice is at $12,000 to $14,000, you know, per month per op. This is a lofty goal for them.
I don't think the majority, I think our audience is further along than that.
Your audience may be, but there are a bunch of millennials that are killing it on Facebook. And then
doing whatever. Yeah. I mean, like,
I actually have clients that actually run the Facebook group and they're close to killing it. Okay. So I'm the guy that looks behind the curtain. So again, there's one thing to say it. There's another thing to actually, it's that rhetoric reality gap that keeps popping up. So I agree with you. That certainly wouldn't be the end of things. I think there's a point, though.
Can we jump to a second metric? Or wrap this thought up, but I want to jump to one more metric.
Okay, I think there is a reason to set a lofty goal, and I think this goal would get you to the point where anything past this is doable by a person that could do that. In other words, you've gotten to the point where you know how to market, you know who you are, you know what you do well, you hire people that compensate for it, you hire more doctors, or you have more rooms, or you grow, or whatever it is, you understand you've gotten to a point where you've really control your future. I think an average practice, many of them can't get off top dead center. That's why. You know.
I agree. I don't disagree with you. Okay. I don't disagree with that. So this one was another one that I jumped out and I didn't love.
Yes.
90% case acceptance.
Okay.
I want the inverse.
Okay, that's fine.
And I'm assuming you very quickly probably know what I mean by that. But so explain to me why you say when you're looking, or the metric to go off of is 90%.
Well, the metrics this is from Howard Ferrand. And most of the stuff I get, I take out of the ADA research area. You know, I look up. Now, I'm not saying that they're good or bad. I mean, you know, I'm just saying you've got, and then I also deal with maybe 10,000 doctors a year that I don't see the numbers for everybody, but at least 10 a week I see it. So again, back to your question on any of these benchmarks, you know, I think we can improve. Part of doing better would be an increased percentage of case acceptance. Now, if you're presenting cases to little kids, because an average practice is going to have some kids, some young adult, some older, maybe you don't have the skill set of placing, doing all on fours or implants or whatever it is. And so your marketing attracts whatever it is. The average practice is going to have a below 60% case acceptance. And Howard Franz says 40%, and that's for occlusal fillings. Okay.
Well, I did love what you said. You say the number one reason people do not have dental work done is that they were never told what they needed to do. Now, okay. I would argue that only one thing I would change in that is I would say the number one reason people do not have dental work done is that they were never given the opportunity to do it. So I don't think it's right. I don't love the word need there. I would say it's giving them the option to, because a lot of the dentistry we do is elective by nature anyways, I mean, in theory.
Frankly, extraction is
like an abscess. Yeah, that's like going to kill them. I love that. And just tell them what they need. Statistically, 67% will say yes. And to me, that's the problem with our profession. Right there.
I agree.
One thing, it's right there.
Oh, I mean, you think about it. We've got to be dentists just because we made better grades than somebody else.
I mean, yeah.
To get in. We get out. I mean, unless you can communicate well and have people skills, you can't help people want what they need. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, you know, and so I'd love to do a program just about case presentation because, I mean, it's not that difficult. But if you're approval addicted, if you think that...
Which most of us are, we were high achieving people that wanted that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if your life is built around, you know, I mean, your self-worth is built around your performance and other people's opinion, you won't ever help them have that choice. And so again, I think a lot of doctors, we've heard that from everybody. I mean, that statement about, you know, they just don't, you know, but evidently it's not soaking in. So how could we tell the audience in a different way how to go about improving that to the point that they did have the options that you had and have and the skill set that you've developed? I mean, you didn't pop from the womb doing this, but your daddy was a successful dentist. So
yeah, I mean, because my thing is like, my target's 10% case acceptance. Cause if I'm presenting $100,000 and I get 10% of that, that's 10 grand, you know, versus 100% case acceptance on $1,000. So,
well, that's not fair either. Okay. I mean, you leave out the middle on everything you say.
Yeah. But I'm trying to extreme it for the quick understanding. Let's do it this way. If I present to you and say, hey, you've got 3 crowns, 2 fillings, Invisalign would benefit you. And are you happy with the way that these 2 front teeth look that have these old fillings? That is the potential for $12,000, $13,000, $14,000. That's not a unique. Now, most of us are like, oh, you got insurance. Okay. Well, we could do this quadrant this year and next quadrant next year. And because we're so terrified to present a number that big, and because most of us don't have back end systems that give patients even the affordability to pay for that, because most people can't back for 17 grand.
Right.
And so like a metric I like to track as it pertains to case acceptance is how much third party financing your makeup, your total collections. Because I know if you have a low third party financing number, then you're not making it difficult for patients to say yes, but you're not presenting enough dentistry. And if 30% of your total collections is third party financing, I know there's a high likelihood that we're presenting dentistry that's getting beyond $400 to $500 out of pocket. And so we're having to find ways to make it more affordable.
Sure. And you give up money when you do that, but it,
you,
I mean, but again, it's the only way. I mean, fiat debt is the only way people survive nowadays, including the doctors.
It's crazy. It's kind of sad, but I saw the boat show last week. You could finance a $150,000 boat for like 20 years.
I know. And the happiest day of your life would be the day you bought it and the day you sell it.
I mean, insane. I was like, I can't afford these boats and I make a good living.
I will add something. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to duel with
people. No, yeah.
There's a different perspective. You know, I mean, I hear people give advice on social media or, you know, areas that, you know, are primarily dental or they're investing or something. And these people have never lived through complete economic cycles.
Yes.
Right? Okay. I mean, like, not like 12 that I have. Okay.
COVID didn't count because we all got free money.
Right. I worry that some of the decisions they make today could really adversely bother, you know, affect them later. And again, I mean, I know what it's like 50 years after graduating from dental school and how 15 people died, 13 by suicide, that, you know, it was, I forgot what the divorce rate was, 70 or 80% divorce rate. Less than 2% were financially independent at age 62. How did we squander the training and the opportunities that we had? And right now we're talking about opportunities. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about opportunities. So
growth, yeah.
Want people to understand that the decisions you make today are real important. And I'd rather you make the decision it be wrong than not make a decision like most people do. And so
I advocate that you like one of the metrics that you mentioned is two hygienists per doctor, and I don't disagree with that. Outside of, I would say that it's two hygienists per doctor as to support the owners of the business, and then outside of that, there's not the need because when push comes tough to shove, and I had to put food on my table because we're in whatever. Well, then associates get fired, extra providers get fired. Like, right. Go back to just doing bread and butter dentistry. So I'm a huge believer that like we shouldn't be creating niche practices or, you know, high end, like whatever implant only practices. You know, I think there's a huge value to the base. Like on some level, what you alluded to is what gave me such a leg up was that I had a solid base. So it allows you when you build the base, it allows you to then be to search for better profit, devoting your time and energy into better profitability. Whereas, yes. And so what I'm on a big picture level, what I'm saying from our first conversation about the operatory is I'm kind of advocating build your base, but then once you build your base, don't just keep building a bigger base. At that point, once you've got your base built, now's the time to start to be riskier in better, higher potential because you're not risking that much.
No, I agree. And at the same time, the caution is the tipping point at which you start to do that. Okay. Whatever level you feel like, okay, I've got the momentum, I've got the trajectory, I'm doing, you know, quite a bit of the stuff I'd like to only be doing. And I have the patient funnel enough to feed that you could minimize the number of people coming through that funnel because now you're marketing just for that pseudo specialty type deal. Again, that works for some people. And again, I certainly wouldn't limit that. If you could go back 40 years, I mean, prior to about 1993, we really had nothing to sell to patients. It was really a needs based, something's broken, fix it. I was doing implants back then, but I mean, it's like, it wasn't all on fours.
Yeah, okay.
And the minute that changed, our rating for reputation and stuff, I mean, like a priest, a physician, Dennis was number three. The minute that changed, we went to number 24, which is just above used car salesman. So obviously we did a real good job of doing that, but it changed the dynamics of the practice of dentistry. And so people like you that are real entrepreneurs make that happen, you know, it's incredible. I just had my teeth redone and paid over $3,000 a unit for it.
I believe it. It's crazy. And again, credit though, Mike, because I'm going to give you not credit and then credit. The not credit is, I think in that regard, you are jumping to a little extreme and saying that like it's either bread and butter dentistry or marketing dentistry.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
I said the tipping point is your validity in your marketplace for what you do.
But that to me, that's tier two to tier three. I think, and this is where I'm trying to give you credit, tier one to tier two.
Yeah.
One doctor to two doctor isn't built off that, in my opinion. It's built off the same, just like there's that, it's just like a need-based thing, is that you essentially told us when I came on and was went by the practice, and we were seeing this a little bit already, is that we didn't need to double our patient base. We just needed to offer the services that we were giving out. So if you have a doctor who has a higher clinical skill set or is willing to invest in that clinical skill set, then all of a sudden tier one to tier two is not a matter of more patients or more soft skills. Yeah. It's more of just you offer different services than the associate and you have the same bucket of patients and you're not competing. And then tier two to tier three almost goes into more of like soft skills, or now we need to bring in more volume.
But if you have an associate that doesn't want to learn and grow like you have learned and grown, I mean, that's kind of weird too. I mean,
you mean the owner?
Well, you said I can, in a way that, you know, when I had that second doctor on the same number of patients, I could take the bread and butter that goes here and I can expand my deal of doing the other. I mean, at some point, that second doctor is going to want to do that too.
That would be the best thing that ever happened.
Oh, it would.
Then, in theory, I have to level up, or then you get into tier two, tier three, which is now we have to turn up the volume.
But now you have to increase the number of patients.
Correct. Absolutely.
So again, at some point, it's always going to be about, you know, new patients, capacity, both in staffing and in facility. And there probably are sweet spots where you get it down and say, okay, from a management dollar cost, return on investment, this would be the logical thing to do. Sometimes the logical thing doesn't work out long term, but you know, on paper, these look fine. So I'm just curious, you know, where you're going eventually with this, because I know your practice pretty well. Not your practice now, but 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, so. Well, for me now, I think one of the biggest things that's allowed me to succeed is this idea of replacing yourself, right? Like,
right.
We all have such fixed bandwidth. And I think that it's amazing how many doctors I interact with that have a great skill set. I was with one a couple weeks ago who he does IV sedation, implant dentistry. He's averaging like one IV case a month. And so the challenge is his ability to grow and do more within the skill set that he has is dependent on getting stuff off of his plate and replacing that with more stuff that he could do. And I would argue it's not a product. I think most people, it's not a product of there's not the opportunity to do it. It's that they're too busy doing other stuff. And so,
okay,
so my model has been built on, as soon as I learn something new, if I want to do more of it, I got to get rid of something. So like that starts off with like very basic things, right? Like fillings. Like I one of the things I like to see people do is start to limit the amount of fillings they'll do per day. You know, like maybe you only see one patient fillings in the morning, one patient fillings in the afternoon. Like you go very, very slow. You don't just like cold turkey, don't do fillings, but you start to limit what you do. And then that availability that gets pushed out naturally will show you this value and need for a doctor that could come in and then you could replace it too. And so that's
now make sure that your audience understands when you say pushed out. What you're talking about is that we have no available time for that single filling. So I could do it in a month.
Absolutely.
Associate could do it today. Okay.
I mean, absolutely.
understand that. Okay.
And then again, that's a leadership issue because most doctors aren't willing to push the filling out or deal with the team being like, hey, we can't get them in for 6 months. And I'd be like, perfect. They can see Megan tomorrow. And then they're like, but you have an opening for tomorrow. I'm like, yeah, that's for an implant.
Yes. A different willingness
to succeed than most people will look at.
Well, and two, you can limit that by schedule too. When I started adding doctors and I've had 80 something associates that ended up being partners and then owners. And I mean, that by limiting my availability, okay, it might be my schedule too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that I'm not I don't work that day.
Right. Yeah. I get on with my dad like that. My dad's like, well, that's the only time they can come in. I'm like, whose name's on?
No, it's not. Okay. I mean, if you've got the validity and you're at that tipping point, people will make time. They realize they're only going to see you a couple of times for whatever it is. And then for the next 15 years, it's not that big a deal.
It's an abundance mindset versus a scarcity mindset a little bit.
You do have to initially have enough patients that when you start doing this, it will still feed the other doctor and they can be productive from a standpoint of not just production, but productive enough that they can take home enough money that's competitive in the marketplace for pay.
Yes. And at the end of the day, like if you're a dentist that only does fillings and crowns, then yes, you're going to have to add two more hygienists to support that associate if you're both going to be doing fillings and crowns. Like at some
point. Well, or if just they're doing it. I mean, at some point.
That's what I'm saying. Like if all of them are, if everyone in all the doctors in the office are just doing fillings and crowns, you're going to have, but I know like for you to do the level of dentistry for you to do $100,000, you only need one hygienist. For another dentist, they need two hygienists. For someone to do $100,000, they need three hygienists just because of the value that you can extract because of either skill set, soft skills, or, you know, financials.
We had a client right out of dental school, wanted to do, now this was back 30 years ago. Okay. So, I mean, I know the dollar amounts aren't going to sound much. We want to do $1 million first year. I said, okay, it's going to cost about $50,000 in marketing. This is scratch practice. He did it. Wanted to do 2 million, did it. Got up to $9 million with four employees and only one of them was a part-time hygienist. Okay. Yeah. Now, again, I mean, you know, that's somebody that could do that, but most of us.
I get that. And I'm not advocating, but hey, if you shoot for that, you end up at 3 million. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, I agree. That's exactly. Okay.
That's where I think we don't disagree that much. Because really the audience that I am attracted to conversating with is that audience that is going from one doctor to two doctors or two doctors to three doctors. And in my opinion, you really don't have to grow the base that much more, or you can't. I prefer to see you change other things, because to grow the base that much more to support more providers, then very quickly we're all going to run into a capacity issue, and then that has a significant upfront cost to expand. You know that
it can. I mean, I've never bought real estate or started a practice. I couldn't pay all of the hard startup in less than 24 months. So, I mean, I'm very cognitive of that. But at the same time, I understand that. But
the mental part, though, the mental part of saying, I'm
right, exactly.
God, that war is bigger. I agree with you. I mean, there's a reason banks give us a ton of money.
Okay.
I definitely agree with you. Well, hey, Mike, I don't want to extend this forever. I mean, I feel like we could keep going. This is a blast. We should definitely do this again because I like the banter. And it makes me better. I mean, ultimately I hear where you're at. I mean, the challenge is like, and honestly, I think that anybody that's any sort of, speaker, influencer, that you're going to project your information onto other people in a way that make them better. It's so important to frame it.
Because
if you don't give that frame, and if you don't give that space around, and that's, I just hate Facebook and social media for that reason, because you'll just throw out one-liners and it's like, well, that doesn't actually work unless they do this, you know? And like, right. Yeah, you can't do that, you know? So anyway, so I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, me too. And again, I think the point is that we all start off chasing success. At some point in your life, you need to change that drive towards significance. And that will change with your age and your competency and stuff. And so it means something. It's not, no matter what it is, it's not wrong. But I think successful people tend to gravitate towards significance rather than just set success as the world would do it. I wrote a series of articles called Stop Thinking Like a Dentist. And it talks about the things we're talking about, you know, that the limitations, the limiting beliefs that you have, that you keep them so long to become truth to you, that I want to help doctors step out of that. And I'm retired. I mean, I don't have to do this.
It's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's fun to help doctors realize that there is something greater than the capacity they've created for themselves.
Or how fast these work is dictated.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Make it work. Okay.
Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed it. We'll talk soon.
Okay. It was great talking to you. I'd love to do this again.
I would too. Everybody works smarter, not harder. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.